You want to start?
Yes, I'd like to start. And like I say, I would like to concentrate on San Diego University with a few diversions elsewhere. So you graduated from San Diego State in 1934. And you spent an entire 4 years there, but it didn't take you longer than 4 years to get your degree?
No, I went right straight through from the beginning. The only hiccup in my education was between high school and college. I was just 16 when I graduated from high school, just barely 16. And I'd skipped some grades, and I was young, and I was small, and I didn't want to go to college with people who were older than me. So I became a hobo and spent a year and a half almost riding freight trains and passenger trains and working on ships and working everywhere across the country. I had one talent only. I was a fast typist, which I learned in high school.
Mm-hmm. And did you use that talent when you were hoboing across the country?
Oh, yes.
Or did you do mostly manual labor?
No. I had tried manual labor, and I found typing much more preferable. I had tried every kind of work, but in 1929, there were no Kelly girls. There were no temps.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a temp. I didn't realize I was preceding and maybe even inaugurating a whole era of new kinds of people, people who were available from time to time. But whenever I got off a freight train or a passenger train or hitchhiking, and I was dressed reasonably right, I went into one of the two offices of either Underwood Elliott Fisher typing or Remington Rand.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? You know, when they asked the bank robber why rob banks, he said, that's where the money is. And so I went to those places because that's what I did. I was a fast, good typist. I competed. I was up to 80 words a minute. And these were all manual typewriters. So I'd sit down and I'd rattle off my typewriter, and within almost always there'd be somebody taking an inventory or having things copied or something, and I'd get 25, 30 cents an hour for typing, and work for a while, like 2 or 3 days or a week. I remember when I got to New York City, I went to an employment agency there, and they said, you're a typist? Yes. I said, they said, what about shorthand? I said, well, I can get by. So they sent me out to a Park Avenue doctor who wanted to have a typist, and he tested me out for shorthand. And of course, I didn't know shorthand.
You didn't know? How did you?
Well, you know, I'm a creative writer. So I just took notes. Then I wrote the letter. And when I gave him back to him, he said, he said, is that what I said? I said, that's what I got. He said, that's rather interesting. And then there was a time, there was a time when I was practically a deckhand aboard a ship going to South America. It was called a cadet, which meant a young man who wanted to train to be an officer in the Maritime Union. But you were really a second-hand deckhand, a second-class deckhand. And about the second day out, painting and scraping and sujiing the deck and all that, there came a note down from the captain that anybody in the crew happened to know how to type. And that's the last time I did any hard work.
I see.
So that was
smart. That was good.
From a practical standpoint, typing, and later in college, typing my papers. Typing was easily one of the best things I ever learned in high school.
It's an awfully good skill to have, isn't it?
So I type all my books, I type all my stuff, I type my notes, I type everything.
Excellent.
And still on a manual typewriter. Because after all the years of being on it, when I got an electric typewriter, I found that I had bad habits of resting my fingers
mm-hmm.
on the keys, and all kinds of strange things are popping up on the page.
I learned how to type on an old manual as well.
So, and once you can do it, of course, it's very good.
It's an excellent skill. when you came back to San Diego, when did you come back to San Diego? Was it 1929?
And 30? I came back, I left in the spring of 1929, and I came back in the fall of 1930.
And you went right to school then? You started.
I came back and went to school. Never occurred to me that I wouldn't go to college. I, as a child, I just thought I'd go to college.
Mm-hmm. But you needed to take a break.
But I needed to catch up on my generation.
Yeah, right, right.
And when I came back, I was 185 pounds and 6 feet one. Instead of playing Class B basketball as a senior in high school, I was now as big as the rest of the kids. And the girls would dance with me. All those good things.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I knew what the world was about. I had seen a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized the value of an education so keenly. Today, of course, it's even more important.
Did that put you on a different level then?
Yes.
Than the other students? I mean, the incoming freshmen then, they hadn't had your life experience by that point.
And incidentally, it put me on a different level with all the people I was working with on ships and other places, hanging up meat in an off-all cooler in St. Paul and doing electric arc welding, which I also didn't know how to do. I took jobs. In fact, my whole life could be characterized by the fact that I was always saying, yes, I'll try something that I really didn't know how to do. Like when the San Diego State Committee asked me to write the Aztec Follies.
Yes.
I had never been to a musical comedy in my life. And I said, I don't know, I think probably I could. So I went to the library and got a book on a musical comedy called Of Thee I Sing, Baby, which was a big hit on Broadway in about 1928. And I read it, and being a sophomore at the time, I thought, well, I could write this kind of stuff. So I wrote the musical comedy. I always, in fact, my wife kiddingly said to me, you know, he said, if you were a girl, you'd have been a prostitute. You said yes to everything.
Yes, but it gave you so many more interesting experiences.
Oh, yes, yes.
A lot of interesting things to think back on.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And you never know what's going to happen.
Never know what's going to happen.
Good choice.
Sure, and that's why I went out and stood on the highway and started going God knows where.
Yeah. When you started school at San Diego State, it was San Diego State Teachers College back then in 1930.
Yes.
And it was still located over there on Normal Street.
That's right. It was a normal school.
Yes.
It was called a normal school. And, of course, it was my third choice.
It was.
Yeah.
Oh, where would you have preferred to go to school?
My first choice was Stanford University to become a lawyer. Which
is... You really wanted to become a lawyer?
Yeah. Because I was a great talker, and I thought it'd be fun to lecture, to do cases and so forth. And it was glamorous, it was rich, and it was famous, and it was the top of the ladder, like a doctor or a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be a lawyer, not a doctor. And... But going to Stanford was so much out of the question. It would be like saying, go to the White House. I had no money. I was sleeping in cars and doing anything work I could get. So the second thing I wanted to do was to be a YMCA secretary, because the Y were my extra fathers. They mm-hmm. brought me up when mm-hmm. I was young.
Explain what a YMCA secretary is. I did read that somewhere. I'm not so sure what
a YMCA secretary is. Like a leader, a Boy Scout leader. And they called them secretaries.
You take charge. There was a
physical directing secretary, and there's a boys' work secretary, and there's a married people secretary. And they went to one of two colleges, either Springfield College in Massachusetts or St. George's in Chicago. And that one closed eventually. So, but at that time, it was hopeful I could go to Springfield, but I couldn't afford to go there either.
Oh.
So the next thing I thought, well, I'd like to be a school teacher. Especially when I could go to a normal school for nothing. And it had one other great attraction to me, and that was teacher tenure. I'd never had any security in my life.
Oh, I see. When you yourself became an elementary school teacher or a teacher of some grade.
Then once I became, I would have permanency.
Uh-huh.
See, I was always impermanent. I was abandoned as a child.
Yes.
My father always away preaching, and I was on my own a lot. I've been a hobo. I was what the Vietnamese. When I was doing shows in North Vietnam in Vietnam during the war, the Vietnamese called the street children Bu Doi. Bu Doi is, in Vietnamese, a speck of dust.
Oh.
And isn't that a marvelous description?
Speck of dust.
Blown by any wind, anywhere, and out of control. And I was I was a Bu Doi. Long before I knew what it meant. And this business of being a YMCA secretary, I'd been a member of the YMCA since I was 10. I was a boys' work. I'd worked at the Y in every job they had possible. I was a towel boy.
Oh, you knew everything.
I ran the telephone switchboard on weekends when they were... It was a hotel YMCA.
Yes.
I was a camp leader every year at Camp Marston out in the back country, Pine Hills, and had camp things out there where I ran programs and emceed shows, even as a kid. And the Y was giving me, and of course they were the guys who taught me to swim and play basketball, and do everything. My life was built around the Y. So naturally, I wanted to be a Y secretary, but I couldn't be one. So then school teaching was the third thing. And one other thing I wanted to be, but I couldn't see how I could ever be that, was to be a lecturer on the Chautauqua Circuit, which they had in those days.
And what is the Chautauqua Circuit?
Chautauqua Circuit really was a little ahead of me, that. But in the 1900s, early 1900s, in Chautauqua, New York, a little town, they had originated a lecture and entertainment, cultural entertainment program that sent people all over the United States speaking at town halls and churches and meetings. And they were stentorian speakers, and some of the great lectures in the history like Daniel Webster and others,
mm-hmm.
clear back, way back, was oratorical.
Uh-huh.
And at San Diego High School, I sat in an assembly and listened to a man speak with all of the florid, exaggerated, dramatic styles of the old-time orator when there was no PA system.
You had to project your voice, obviously.
And I thought, that is wonderful. And I went up and talked to him afterwards, and he was very kind to me. And now here I am with my own lecture circuit all over
That's
the world.
That's right. That's right.
So I came all the way back to what I wanted to be clear in high school before I knew I wanted to be anything.
However, in a way, what you had been doing in the intervening years was similar.
Yes.
Because you were obviously,
speaking to
a group of people as you were interviewing others.
I was not only getting the experience and knowledge and wisdom, but I was getting the reputation.
Right. You've got to have that reputation before you can go out there and do that kind of stuff.
To really make money.
Uh-huh.
There are thousands of speakers who have no reputation at all except their own hometown. There's books of speakers.
That's okay.
And that's fine. And they speak on what they... my trip down the Amazon River with the Baptist Church.
Let me ask you about the old campus.
Yes.
Take you back to the old the old normal school campus. What was it like? What were your impressions?
To begin with, there were only 500 or 600 students. And we were there right on a busy street. And it was an old building. And we didn't have any special athletic programs that we could fit into. We weren't at college. There wasn't any room to play or practice. And I started out, because of my YMCA experience, I started out, if I was going to be a school teacher, I was going to be a physical education teacher, because I was always a sportsman. And by the end of the first year, the great thing the first year did for me was to open my eyes to the wide world of knowledge that went far beyond physical education. So immediately I was challenged.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the instructors that you remember that challenged?
Well, one of my favorite instructors, early one, was Dean C.E. Peterson, because I wanted to be...
Well, he was physical education.
Physical education. Huh? So he was one of my first ones. And he was the one who used to lecture to the freshman class and tell them that pep without purpose is piffle. That was, you know, the original positive thinking things. And then I met Florence Smith, my English teacher. And she had about as much to do with changing, and Harry Steinmetz, the psychology professor, mm-hmm. that was in the second or third year, but the first couple of years, Florence Smith, she was the one who opened my eyes to creative writing. Then I had a public speaker. I took public speaking because I love to speak. And
do you recall who the instructor was for public speaking?
No, I don't. In high school, I recall my public speaker. His name was Hammond. And he got me started public speaking in high school. He used to get me up in front of the class to show off to the other students. I didn't realize he was doing that. He'd give me a public speaking subject, and then I'd get it started and get it organized, ad lib. And then he'd stop me and give me another topic to show how I could jump around.
I forgot
about
that.
Yeah. And that
made you think on your feet.
Yes, I was able to, and that gave me the idea that I could always do it. And then I began volunteering. Of course, the great thing about being in a college of only 500-600 students is that they're always looking for volunteers for everything, mm-hmm. because any activity. And so I began volunteering for everything.
In between working, I understand you worked all the time too.
Oh, I was always working.
So you had time to volunteer to do things too. Huh?
Yes, wow. I'm always busy. Always had more things to do than I could do, and always well organized, because I learned very early how important prioritization is. Mm-hmm. Reorganizing your time according to what you are going to get the best use of it.
Yes, yes.
And that changes almost every day when you're young.
That's right.
And I joined a fraternity, Tau Delta Chi.
What was that again?
Tau Delta Chi, T-A-U Delta Chi. We only had local fraternities. It later became ATO, Alpha Tau Omega. After I left college, mm-hmm. we didn't have nationals until I was gone.
Do you remember the name Sue Wolfer?
Yeah.
Yeah, Sue Wolfer Ernest, her married name. She eventually later did a very nice, concise history of all the sororities and fraternities on the SDSU campus. All the name changes and all
yes.
the affiliation changes over the years.
Yes.
Wonderful thing that she did for us.
And
so
and
you remember Sue.
Yes,
she's,
certainly.
She's going strong.
Is she?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I can't remember who was president then of the college.
I didn't bring any yearbooks, but I did bring a couple of other miscellaneous pieces of paper. I won't try to pull that
and stuff. And of course, I did play, freshman football. We did have a football team because I played freshman football because I was one of the big guys now. And I'll never forget at the end of the first quarter, the coach called us all in. He said, "How are your grades?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "You don't know." He says, "We better find out." He came back. He says, "Gee, you're getting all A's." I said, "Well, good." He said, "No wonder you weren't worried," or something like that.
Yeah.
But then I hated football.
Oh, you decided you didn't like that game, huh? That sport.
Well, you know, it's an interesting story, but when they had the first gathering of the young guys who wanted to play football, a number of them had played football in high school. I never had because I was too small. So I went to the back of the room, being smart, because everybody was signing up. So I went to the back of the room and signed up for the position that had the fewest number of names. There was only one other name, and that was for center. And I learned that that was the worst job.
Oh, no, not when you haven't played before, certainly.
And I
you
was...
get the most punches that way.
And yeah, you had played both. In those days, we played the whole game. We didn't play defense or offense. And you have just awful. Then freshman basketball came along after that, and I immediately, yes?
I'm sorry to interrupt. Dean Sicoli with Larry King Show.
So he'll take your lead and ask you questions depending on what the mood is. Well, I wanted to ask you about the moving of the campus.
The moving of the campus was a big, big thing because, number one, we were going out into Indian territory, practically. It was out in the hills. It had never been developed out beyond East San Diego on the way to El Cajon, in a place where I, as a kid, had roamed the hills, and they had a bunch of caves called Old Man Young's Caves.
Old Man Young.
Old Man Young's Caves. And these were holes dug in by some old hermit, probably very dangerous. And there was a spring. There was a small, kind of a spring, kind of a little runway down.
Well, would be surprised because
and it had pools. And we used to swim in them.
Dobie
Falls.
Mm-hmm.
Dobie Falls, and Old Man Young's Caves. So now I found myself going out there, and there were no houses and there were no buildings except the campus. By that time, the school had grown to maybe 700 or 800.
There's a map.
Yeah.
Of the campus in 32.
May 1st, 1932.
The second open house of the campus.
See, I returned home in 1930. So I started in 1930, this fall of 1930.
Fall of 30. And
graduated in the spring of 34.
The first classes were to be held on this campus were in the winter of 31, right?
I guess.
It was January, February.
The dedication program was May 1st of 1932.
So they must have moved in January, February, and then had a dedication ceremony in the springtime. Did you help out with the move? Were you one of the guys that I've seen in a photograph with a table on their backs, lugging the furniture around on campus?
Of course.
In the rain?
In everything.
In the mud?
It was, we were moving on trucks and everything else.
I've heard a story that they had a tractor out there that they kept there for at least a couple of years to pull cars out of the mud when they would get stuck.
I guess so. I never had a car. I had a bicycle, maybe. Campus of 125 acres, valued at $100,000, given by Bell Lloyd Company. Scripps Cottage, landscaping, Sigma Pi Theta.
when you were going to school at San Diego State, or the normal school, or teacher's college, actually, where did you live?
Well, it depends on the year. The first year, I lived in the home of one of my good friends who had gone with me on my trip, Denver Fox.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Denver Colorado Fox. And he was a member of the Fox family, which was quite a San Diego State. They two older brothers were athletes, and they'd gone there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stayed with them, and I worked at the college. I worked, of course, in the cafeteria, made Waldo salads and soup, and
mm-hmm.
served things. Of course, I waited table.
This is when the cafeteria was over there. It was shared space with a little bookstore.
Yeah.
Correct?
That's right.
And there were two men, guys who ran the cafeteria.
That's right.
Then.
Yeah, everybody knew them.
I remember their names right now.
I can't either, but I should. But they were Italian, I think, names, mm-hmm. or Spanish.
What other odd jobs did you hold on campus?
Huh?
What other odd jobs? What other unusual jobs did you hold there on campus?
Well, I did a lot of work for the professors. I was reader in several classes in geology for Sewell, Mrs. Sewell, S-U-H-L.
Oh, Storm, Alvina Sewell.
Alvina
Storm.
Sewell. And Steinmetz, I read for him. And Florence Smith, I read for her. Then after school, I worked at the YMCA quite a bit. And I was a painter's helper, because the second year, I lived at the home of another friend of mine, and his name was Gordon Samuels, and his father was a builder of homes. They'd build a home, and then they'd sell it. And we'd live in garages while they were building the home.
Oh, I see.
And we'd all sleep in the garage.
You didn't have a lot of belongings, did you?
No, I had no belongings. funny story. I won a contest either the first or second year of college, Phi Beta Kappa essay contest.
Mm-hmm.
I got third place in the state.
Wow.
In the category we were in, whatever it was. And Florence Smith got me to submit a thing.
That's no small feat. That's very good.
And so what my prize was a $200 worth of books for my library.
For your personal library or
yes,
the university's library?
For my personal library. I mean, this was the Phi Beta Kappa, what they were going to award. They didn't know who would get it. So I remember I went down to a bookstore in San Diego, and I said to a man, what books have the greatest resale value that you'd buy back from me if I could bring them into you? And
so
he gave me a list. And it talked about an eclectic list. It had nothing to... When they looked at it, you know, I can't remember what they were. It might have been The Rise and Fall of Rome, chemistry, physics, stuff.
Uh-huh. All over.
And they
the
said,
spectrum.
I never saw such a list of books from a man, young man with such wide intellectual...
Wide-ranging interests.
Yes. And I took them right down and boom.
And you sold them.
Sold them.
For money. What was the bookstore you sold them to? Was it Warren Brock's by any chance?
Might have been. One of the big ones in San Diego. I can't remember.
Hmm.
Then I got a job because I was always available for any kind of odd job around. It might be babysitting, or it might be washing cars.
So yours was purely a cash lifestyle.
I was a gypsy.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I was a gypsy, and then I lived with Gordon Samuel as a painter's guy for a while. I did work in the places he was painting. I mean, building. I always got to paint the closets. That's what a painter's helper gets.
Oh, you get
you're
to paint
inside
the
closet. One
hot.
Summer.
Smelling.
I remember one summer I worked as a out in a canyon someplace in the backcountry with a pavement breaker building a small dam for the county.
Really?
In August.
Oh,
and that
no.
was one of the worst jobs I ever had. And then I began to be a lifeguard at Del Mar.
Were you really?
And La Jolla.
Uh-huh.
As I have said in some of my lectures, I saved many beautiful young girls who had no idea they were in trouble.
Let me take you off on a little tangent here then about your lifeguard work. I know that you surf, or you surfed. Do you still surf?
Yes.
Did you pick up surfing when you were a lifeguard?
Body surfing, yes. Everybody was body surfing.
Uh-huh.
No, I didn't learn board surfing until much later.
Uh-huh.
But we were great, great body surfers. And I was in all the big events. I swam across the Silver Gate between North Island and the Point Loma. And I did the oceanside rough water swims.
Wow.
And then I was... I tried out for the Olympics in 32. I was one of the top Pacific Coast backstroke champions.
Wow, that's impressive.
And I was a basketball star from the first time I set foot on the court as a freshman. And as a matter of fact, the coach, football coach, to go back to that for a minute, when he saw me play basketball, came up to me and he said, "What were you doing playing center on our football team?" And I said, "Well, I didn't know anything about it, and I was just trying to learn." He says, "Next year," he says, "you're going to be a halfback or an end." He says, "You handle the ball, and you have all the moves." I said, no. "You will never see me on a football team again. I don't like football." So I didn't play it. But I was a high-scoring guy, and then in those days they didn't have big guys, so I was 6'1", and I was big. I was center on our championship team.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But we had another center named Tucker, who was center when I was first playing forward. He was a center. He was about 6'3", or 4". I remember all the guys I played with. We were quite a bunch. We went all the way through. We were always winning all the championships.
It's just quite
great.
A history of that,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
And lots of good photographs of all that. It must have been a lot of fun.
But I had my YMCA jobs. I had my lifeguard jobs. I had my jobs... of course, long before that, I was a newspaper boy and had newspaper roots.
You had a newspaper
roots. Oh, sure. I was a newspaper boy in junior high school. And just worked at everything. I always worked.
When you came back to San Diego after traveling around the country and working, where were your parents at this time? Your adopted parents? They moved away. So you were in San Diego without any relatives.
Yeah. They had moved up to Central California and then finally to Pomona, and that's where they lived till they died there.
Mm-hmm.
And I never lived with them again because our lives just were different.
Mm-hmm. You took different paths.
Different people.
Mm-hmm.
Different... they were sweet people, kind and loving, warm, very devout. Not well educated.
Mm-hmm. Kind.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, you lived, obviously, then in various locations in San Diego when you were going to school. How did you get to school? Did you walk? Did you ride your bike?
Well, when I went to San Diego High School, I lived in East San Diego. And I took the streetcar quite a bit.
Good old streetcar.
But I didn't take it the normal way.
How did you take it?
I went in the regular way and went out the back.
What do you mean? You went in the regular way? You mean so you wouldn't have to
in,
pay?
I came in. You didn't pay. You paid on the way out. And I never went out. I went out the back window.
And did you ever get caught?
Yep. Went out one time, and there was a police car just happened to be following, and I went out of the window and right into the car.
And he gave you a ride the rest of the way, right?
Yeah. And in junior high school, Woodrow Wilson Junior High School, I won the prize of the Rotary Scholarship Prize of the Year, $100, and they had an auditorium, and John Azeltine was the principal there, and then he became principal of San Diego High School.
Uh-huh.
And he was one of my mentors, by the way. He was one of the fellows who, and Dave Bomberger at the San Diego Y was another one of my fathers. There were people who took care of me and guided me and helped me. Because I would have been a rascal, not having any money. A lot of people become thieves. A lot of people become gang leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have been one of those. Because I was bound to get ahead.
They did steer you in the right direction, though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been in trouble.
Yeah.
And
thank goodness for them.
And I did my amount of early years of stealing in stores. And
a little shoplifting.
Yeah.
Talking about.
Yeah. And jumping out the back end of a streetcar. But anyhow, I won this prize for $100, and they didn't have it. But John Azeltein, in front of the whole student body, told all about what a good student I was. And it was a rainy. It was a morning. It was about 11 o'clock, and it was a rainy day. And I was flushed with triumph, and so I said to a guy, Let's skip lunch and go downtown and go to a movie. And we hitchhiked too. Did a lot of hitchhiking, all over hitchhiking. So we went down to San Diego, and we were picked up by a truant officer at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm back at the principal's office in the custody of a truant officer for skipping school after having just been the hero. And that was when John Azeltine had a long, serious talk with me, and he held up the $100 on probation for a month or
did
two.
He did
all the things he should have done. I was an adventurous kid.
Yeah.
I took chances.
He had things to do.
And could very well have been killed on the freight train or been held up by robbers with guns.
You took chances, didn't you?
Huh?
You took chances.
Yeah. I was lying on top of a lumber car in Walla Walla, Washington, one rainy night, waiting for the train to pull out, and a couple of guys came across the top of the lumber with matches and a revolver and held me up.
Really?
Uh huh.
Wow.
So, and then I was on ships, and I would go ashore with all the sailors, and we'd all go to a big prostitution red light district with
mm-hmm.
all the sailors, and I'd sit in the I would sit in the parlor talking to the girls and asking them how they got there and what they did.
So you were interviewing
always
these
all my
women,
life
huh?
all my life.
Uh-huh.
And I still have a diary that I kept on that ship. And I have the girls, Elena and so forth, and what their names were.
Were they giving, do you suppose they were telling you the truth?
Yeah, sure. I was so young. And before I went on the trip, I had a long talk with a a doctor who was a friend of mine. I don't know how we got to be friends. And he told me all the bad things would happen to me if I took chances.
Uh-huh.
And I never did.
Well, that was smart. That was good.
On the way back from Buenos Aires, half the sailors had the various venereal diseases.
Oh, no.
And I didn't have one. But I would have, maybe.
Good. Good for you. Glad you listened.
So that my life, I've taken a lot of chances.
Yeah. But you also used your brains. You used your head.
I was a smart kid.
So, what is the story behind the Aztec Follies? I got the impression that the Aztec Follies, the years prior to when you wrote it, was getting some criticism from the university administration. It was kind of going off the deep end too much. They were not pleased with some of the vocabulary or some of the message that was coming across.
If this was so, I didn't know it.
Okay.
I, at the time, was writing a weekly column, humor column, for the paper, among all the other things.
I guess I better look that up. I didn't realize that.
Yes, every week
it was, and your name was attached to it?
Uh-huh.
Because oftentimes the names aren't
yes.
there.
Yes, oh yeah. Yeah, my name was on it. And so it was a humor column. I wrote about the funny things around the campus and jokes that I stole from any place I could find the jokes. And also I was chairman of... I did some debating, and I did some emceeing of shows around on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
So I was getting well known. I remember one time I ran a big treasure hunt that started out on the campus on the mesa there, and I was busy doing other things, and I had places where I was going to place the clues, you know,
yeah,
all around. For
all
miles around.
Uh-huh.
And I got late, and for some reason or other, and I was just ahead of them all the way.
Wait, just barely ahead of them?
I was just barely ahead of them. I'd put down the clues and go back out before they came there.
Oh, no. Look, there's Art. Just follow him.
So, anyhow, I was doing all those things, so one day a committee approached me, some girl, I can't remember her name now. She says, how would you like to write the Follies for next year? And I said, well, I don't know. I don't know anything about Follies. She said, well, why don't you think about it? And I went to the library and got the book, and I said, yeah, I think I could write a Follies. And so they got a man named John Crofton, who was a student out there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was studying music. So he was going to write the music, and I was going to write the book and the lyrics. And so I wrote this book called Pressure, about a boy and a girl, and they were in love, and their mother and father were single, parents, widow or something, and they didn't like the other child, and so they both went to the same doctor, and so the boy and the girl conspired with the doctor that one of them had low blood pressure and one of them had high blood pressure. And he prescribed for them a cruise on a summer boat down to Mexico. Aztec.
Uh-huh.
We were Aztecs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the two could get together on the boat. And then we were down in Mexico and the Aztecs and all that stuff. So Johnny Crofton and I wrote the music, and I wrote the lyrics.
Was it a success when it was put on?
Well, it must have been, because the talk about, you know, how things string together. One of the people who saw it was a manager of the local radio station, KGB.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
His name was Lincoln Deller, and he talked to Harry Steinmetz, who was a psychology professor, who kind of ran the faculty talks on the radio station, free, you know, how the campus interacts.
Yes, uh-huh.
And he said, do you know this young man who wrote this song? And Harry Steinmetz said, yes, he's He works for me, too, as a reader in psychology. And he said, well, what's his name? And so I was making Waldorf salads, and the phone rang, and it was him on the phone. I didn't know who he was. He said, how would you like to have a part-time job in radio? And of course, I said, yes.
Of course.
I would have said, if he'd been Gravedigger.
You would have said yes.
This was 1933.
Yeah.
This was the bottom of the Depression now, not 29, but the real Depression. And it wasn't affecting me especially because I was doing all kinds of menial work. But I always could find a job. I could always make out. I could land in any town not knowing anybody because I knew I'd done it before.
Mm-hmm. And you could always...